Our message is very simple. If you have any issues with the approval of Shell's permits, let's talk about those issues in court right now.
Shell Oil asks a judge for a decision on their spill response plan process before it's even challenged. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the governor defends his email campaign against the Senate oil tax plan.
I told the truth. The commissioner told the truth. We're all here trying to get the job done for Alaskans.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Enjoy high school hoops in Anchorage during the 2012 ASAA March Madness State Basketball Championships, March 12th through 17th. Come early and stay late to enjoy Anchorage's big wildlife with events, shopping, dining, and activities for the whole family. For more information on what to see and do in Anchorage, explore anchorage.net/Alaskans, your source for Anchorage information. This message sponsored by Visit Anchorage.
A North Slope building that processes oil for shipment in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was brought back online today after a fire. BP Alaska spokesman Steve Reinhart said that employees noticed a flame in an unoccupied low-pressure gas handling building and heard a loud noise Wednesday at Prudhoe Bay Gathering Center 2. He says the fire extinguished itself and responding crews found no apparent damage. A full inspection will be conducted. He says no oil spill or loss of containment has been noticed. There were no injuries and the plant was shut down as a precaution. He says impact to production hasn't been determined by the one-day shutdown. Reinhart says the gathering center is one of about 12 on the North Slope that process oil for shipment. Shell Alaska has taken an unusual step in asking a federal court yesterday for a declaratory judgment on their Arctic spill response plan that was approved by the Department of Interior in February. Shell is seeking this judgment against a number of environmental and conservation groups in an effort to end run the litigation that will likely challenge the process that was used to approve their plan. Shell Alaska spokesman Curtis Smith says the company wants a judge to consider sooner rather than later the merits of the spill response plan approval process.
We filed a very narrow scope talking about the process itself. It's possible that the merits of the plan itself will be challenged, but that will likely come in another court. And it's my understanding that's already been taken up by a different court in California.
Smith says if a federal judge agrees to review the plan and issue a decision, it has the potential to bind future litigation in that court. Shell's court filing names several organizations, including the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, and the Alaska Wilderness League.
There are a number of opposition groups named, and historically, those are the opposition groups that have used the courts as a stall tactic. And if nothing else, we have no intention of sitting back and waiting for that to happen.
Smith says Shell's preemptive move does not prohibit challenges to the permits, but may limit the company's exposure to last-minute injunctions and 11th-hour challenges, he says, is what they want to avoid.
And those, of course, have the potential to derail our plans, and we have very small windows in which we can work. So to add any possible certainty to our program, we have filed this declarative judgment in hopes that we can add that last second certainty. In other words, our message is very simple. If you have any issues with the approval of Shell's permits, let's talk about those issues in court right now.
The petition was filed in U.S. District Court in Anchorage. A call to Alaska Wilderness League attorney Peter Van Tine was not returned by airtime. The U.S. Coast Guard will send its newest national security cutter, the 420-foot Berthoff, to the Arctic for this summer's open water season. That's in addition to a buoy tender and two helicopters. The Guard is preparing for more traffic and anticipated offshore oil drilling through their Arctic Shield effort. If Shell moves ahead with exploratory drilling this summer, the company expects to have 22 vessels in the region and 6 aircraft. They plan to fly more than 300 trips from land to the drilling rigs to ferry 400 employees around. Rear Admiral Thomas P. Ostebo, the commander of District 17, was in Nome yesterday to speak with Native Corporation and city leaders.
When you have this much activity going on, there's always a possibility of collisions, groundings, helicopter mishaps, aircraft going into Barrow at 3 times the normal rate to bring all these people up there. One of them has a mishap. The Coast Guard's going to be there to do all the missions, our 11 statutory missions on the North Slope, which heretofore we haven't done much of. So we're looking to take our normal mission set and move it to an area of the nation where In the past, we haven't been.
The Guard is adding a temporary airbase and communication station in Barrow. They also plan to do their first ever oil spill response drill in Arctic waters. No oil will actually be spilled, but they will test their ability to deploy and operate skimming equipment. Traffic through the Bering Strait is again expected to break records, with upwards of 1,000 vessels transiting the strait. Ostebo says in preparing for Shell's drilling program, people should step back and take a holistic view of growth in the Arctic. Ostebo points to massive Russian tankers carrying Norwegian gas condensate that made it through the strait this past summer.
The U.S. has really no control over that. That's foreign flag vessels operating between two sovereign nations going to a third nation to deliver it. My point is that there's a lot of activity going on, and that the United States is just now, I think, beginning to realize, quite frankly, how much of that activity is going on right in our own backyard. And we're also realizing that we don't have full control over that. A lot of times we like to think that we're managing all this and we're in charge. We're not.
Ostebo says the country should be looking at ways to organize vessel traffic lanes and improve communication among those navigating through the area. Ostebo was asked about anti-whaling protesters and the Guard's ability to respond if subsistence hunters are harassed. He says the Guard's jurisdiction is limited beyond 12 miles offshore and says he'll be sending Nome residents a legal analysis of what the Guard can do in different areas. Shell is planning on using Dutch Harbor as its logistics hub for the drilling season. Nome's port will see some action. The cutter Alex Haley is expected to make port calls in Nome a couple of times, along with buoy tenders. Shell must still secure individual well permits in order to go ahead with this summer's program. If Shell is successful, ConocoPhillips and Statoil hope to drill in the next two summers. Friction continues in the Capitol surrounding those Action Alert emailed messages inviting people to give their opinions on the Senate's oil tax bill that's being written this week. The governor, the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and Chamber of Commerce all announced the teleconference hearings to encourage participation by their members and supporters. Senate Resource Committee co-chair Joe Pascvan, when asked about the alerts at a press conference on Tuesday, said the public could find them misleading. Along with his response to the emails, he said the governor's message specifically cast doubts on the Department of Revenue.
The statement in the governor's action alert that indicates that Senate Bill 192 is a tax increase. And I would point out that the Department of Revenue's fiscal note indicates, quote, given the Department of Revenue's fall 2011 oil price production and lease expenditure forecast through FY 2017, the tax rate changes from this bill are not projected to have a direct revenue impact. So in other words, it's not a tax increase.
Pascvan also said the committee's second version, called the committee substitute, had also gotten a response by the Revenue Department showing a $250 million annual reduction in tax revenue.
So neither, according to the Department of Revenue, the Senate Bill 192 nor the committee substitute for 192 are tax increases.
In his own press conference today, Governor Parnell said Pascvan's criticism contained, quote, broad sweeping statements, meaning it was not specific, and he defended the emails.
I sent out a legislative action alert saying get down there, offer public testimony. My statement expressly referenced SB 192, which was a tax increase because they took the cap off in the original version. The slide that Commissioner Butcher offered that is being offered as you know, something different than I said, was related to the committee substitute for SB 192. This is a moving target, and there was no inconsistency in the statements made.
Pascvan's comments were specific enough to include both the original bill and the substitute, and both statements gave the Department of Revenue as the source. Parnell called on the public and legislators to stop, take a breath, and dig into what was actually said.
I told the truth. The commissioner told the truth, and that we're all here trying to get the job done for Alaskans.
The Senate Resources Committee took two evenings of public testimony on the tax reform issue. A final committee version will be released and sent to the Finance Committee next week. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, doubling up on adventure for identical twins running the Iditarod.
And he's like, oh, hey, you want to come up and handle dogs this winter? And I was like, yeah, can my twin sister come too? He's like, you got a twin sister? Bring her along. And
that's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A 55-year-old man was reportedly beaten to death on Tuesday night in Unalaska. Jonathan Adams of Washington suffered fatal injuries after allegedly being assaulted by co-workers at a local seafood processing plant. Denison Soraya, 41, and 35-year-old Leonardo Bongalto, Jr., both face charges of murder in the first degree for the crime. The state has set bail for each of them at $250,000. Two Fairbanks residents pleaded guilty Tuesday to multiple hunting crimes. The father-son duo illegally shot a moose on the same day they were airborne. KUAC's Emily Schwing has the story.
In late September 2011, Alaska wildlife troopers in Fairbanks received a call from a hunter who said he may have witnessed someone hurting a moose with a small airplane. Andrew Peterson is an assistant attorney general in the Office of Special Prosecutions for the state.
From an outside observer, two guys flying into an airport with a moose in an airplane, there's nothing that even is suspicious about that type of activity. So, but for the witnesses in this case, the state would have had no idea that a same-day airborne event had happened.
When 22-year-old Kevin Foster II landed his Cessna at Fairbanks International Airport with moose meat on board, wildlife troopers were there to meet him.
He made some admissions at that point in time, and the second bit of luck I would say that we had in this investigation was that Foster Sr.'s phone died, so he was unable to receive calls.
The next day, troopers approached 46-year-old Kevin Foster Sr. at a remote hunting camp 40 miles south of Fairbanks. With no cell phone access, he had no idea they had already questioned his son.
One of the most important aspects of a fish and game sentence is general deterrence. It's to send a message to what are normally law-abiding citizens that it's not worth the risk to, you know, take an animal same-day airborne because the consequences can be severe. And that's what wildlife troopers really have to rely upon because there's so few troopers in so much area, right?
Peterson says he prosecutes up to a dozen similar cases every year in Alaska.
Probably two of the most egregious offenses you can commit would be either a same-day airborne offense or a wanton waste offense, where you kill the animal and you waste the meat. How many of them do we know about? That's, you know, that's kind of why we have this type of sentence.
Kevin Foster Jr. pled guilty to illegal possession or transportation of game. Foster Sr. pled guilty to taking game on the same day his aircraft was in flight. The two will pay a combined $8,000 in fines. Foster Sr. will forfeit his hunting privileges for 5 years, as well as the moose hide meat and antlers and a rifle. The two men will also forfeit their aircraft to the state. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Providence Hospital in Anchorage is expanding a system that's helping nurses and doctors deliver better care to critically ill patients. It's called the Electronic Intensive Care Unit, or EICU. It adds an extra layer of care for patients in the Anchorage ICU and even allows staff in Anchorage to help treat patients in rural hospitals around the state and the Pacific Northwest. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Frances Lynch is used to the active life of a bedside nurse, but lately she spends half of her shifts at a simple office desk stacked with 6 computer monitors. The familiar squiggles of a heartbeat roll across one screen.
If they were to have an abnormal rhythm, we could see it right away and alert the bedside nurse.
Lynch functions as an extra set of eyes for the bedside nurse. She's constantly monitoring the patient's breathing rate, blood pressure, and oxygen level. She can see the patients, too, with a camera that allows her to zoom in or out and pan around the room.
I was watching somebody. She's in behind the curtain right now, but I'm just kind of keeping an eye on her for the bedside nurse who's afraid she might try to leave.
The picture is sharp enough for Lynch to look at pupil responses or assess the tubes that are keeping many ICU patients alive. She could monitor as many as 33 patients from this one station, but on a typical day, Lynch is watching around 24. Cecily Rouge is clinical manager of the EICU. She says the concept is really pretty simple.
You know, you take some 21st century technology and apply some expertise behind it, and you can provide additional support for the patients and the staff that are working at the bedside.
During the day, the EICU nurse is alone at the station, but for 10 hours each night, a doctor works there too. That's important because in the past, ICU nurses would have to call a sleeping doctor to ask a question or request an order at night. Rouge says sometimes nurses were reluctant to do that. Now problems that crop up can be dealt with right away.
We also are very protective of the doctors, and so, you know, if we could give them, oh, I think that they're doing okay, you know, the patient's doing okay right now, I'll call them in just a little bit and let them know. Well, now, because we have the physician who's awake, there's not that, I'm going to wait just a little bit to call the physician. They're calling, they're getting the order right away.
Providence started the electronic ICU 3 years ago. In 2010, they began using the system to monitor beds at remote hospitals. Providence's hospital in Kodiak was the first to come on board. Bonnie Neff is the patient care nurse manager in Kodiak. She says having the extra support from the EICU has been amazing.
It's awesome. Anybody that lives in a rural community having the EICU is a huge asset.
Neff says on average, the hospital only uses the EICU about 6 times a month. But during those times, it's extremely useful. She describes a typical scenario.
They're on our floor. We're stabilizing them. The weather turns bad. We can't get them to Anchorage because nobody's flying.
Neff says the EICU staff provides guidance on tricky and often life-saving procedures. And since the system first started a year and a half ago, she estimates the EICU has prevented about 17 patients from being medevaced to Anchorage. She says a typical medevac costs $20,000. And the EICU's clinical manager, Cecily Rouge, says on the human side of things, the benefits are just as huge.
And so 17 patients got to stay with their families, got to stay in their own community. And what a, you know, benefit that is for them, not only in the costs of the transfer and the cost of staying here in Anchorage, but being able to get the health care in the communities that they live in is really important.
Critics of EICUs say the concept costs a lot of money and hasn't yet proven it can improve patient care. But a 2011 study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found EICUs prevent deaths by helping doctors follow best clinical practices. The study also showed EICUs cut 2 days off the average length of a hospital stay. Rouge says at Providence so far, the EICU is sending patients home close to a day early.
Working together, we're trying to improve that even more, having people come off the ventilators quicker, because if they can come off the ventilator, they can leave the ICU quicker. And so we're really working together as a collaborative team to improve, you know, ongoing what we can do for our patients.
Besides Kodiak, the Anchorage EICU is now monitoring patients at Bartlett Hospital in Juneau. A Providence hospital on the Oregon coast called Seaside also joined the system. Providence is hoping more rural hospitals will follow. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, we know the territory. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The World Ice Art Championships are underway in Fairbanks. It's the first year at a new home for the annual carving competition and kids' fun park. As KUAC's Dan Barras reports, like the sculptures, the ice park is a work in progress.
A former construction yard is being transformed into a winter wonderland. It's taking a lot of ice and hard work.
ICE Alaska Chairman Dick Brickley surveys the site on opening day as crews swarm around finishing up projects, including an ice block banner for title sponsor BP.
There they're making the BP logo. Oh, awesome. Kenichi, great. Beautiful. Beautiful.
Things are a little rough, but okay, Brickley says just having an event is a big deal given the recent move, which included transport and construction of several large buildings. He credits an army of volunteers with making it happen.
We've been working day and night. People from all over have come in to help. The IBEW has come in and really has been supportive in helping us get our electrical situation squared away. We've just had tremendous help from the community, honestly. And it's plumbing, electrical work, just clean up, building the roads, cutting in the, moving and stacking the ice, harvesting the ice.
Brickley says there's a lot of work still to be done to make the ice park what organizers envision. He says this year's 165-foot-long kid slides fall short of the 300 to 500-foot-long runs planned.
That has to be in the future because, quite frankly, you know how much we've done. Just to have the slides in is a miracle.
The ice park includes a lot of familiar attractions like the slides, an ice maze, and animal sculptures for kids to play on.
Come on,
okay, okay, I'm ready. Look at your damn wall.
Say, look at
you're on a polar bear.
The fun at the ice park is mixed with serious art as carvers prepare works for the World Ice Art Championships. Ice artists use everything from massive chainsaws to grinders and tiny chisels to turn simple ice blocks into dazzling forms. Sculptor Aaron Kostick of Ohio works from a paper pattern as he and a partner begin a complicated project in the single block competition.
This piece is called Feather, and it's a Native American with a headdress. Coming up out of him is a female's torso, and she has an eagle headdress on top of her head. I really like the idea of the woman and the man together. It's almost like a totem, but not exactly. You know, it's kind of a paying some homage to the our Native Americans, you know.
Another carver, Rodrigo Ferreira, dressed like a lumberjack in protective gear, is developing a piece with a socio-political theme inspired by the home foreclosure crisis.
From the big block here, there's going to be a door and some elements of an abandoned house in reference to the state of the world economy nowadays. This is a very bad situation, and it's not only happening here in the U.S., it's all over the world. So this is my statement about that theme.
Ferreira is from Portugal, one of many carvers in the Ice Art Championships from foreign countries, giving the event and carvings international flair. Their works are on display at the ice park through the end of March. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race gets underway this weekend. The race has had its share of unusual mushers over the years. There have been blind mushers, one-legged mushers, a musher in kilts, even three generations of one family all running in the same race. But this year, race viewers may do a double take when identical twins Christy and Anna Barrington take to the runners. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
If Christy and Anna Barrington didn't wear their hair differently, it would be about impossible to tell them apart. The northern Wisconsin natives are used to being addressed as one person. Christy, that's the twin with the ponytail, and Anna, the one with the long braids, are good-natured about taking the ribbing twins often get about their similarities. Actually, they do finish each other's sentences and sometimes speak in unison.
Just turned 28.
The twins started running dogs pretty early in life, even building their first sled out of a milk crate and some old skis.
Our neighbor had sled dogs, so we'd go over there and play with her puppies, and when we got big enough, she gave us like a little three-dog team to run around and her veteran dogs to use that she trusted that wouldn't take us for a loop, and we just did a few races and fell in love with it.
So did you do those one dog, two dog races?
Yeah, like three dog,
four dog races at the most. They came to Alaska to work with 1984 Iditarod champion Dean Osmar.
Ultimately, it was because of dogs. I came up for a summer and met Dean Osmar, and we got to talking, and he knew that we ran dogs in the lower 48, and he's like, oh, hey, you want to come up and handle dogs this winter? And I was like, yeah, can my twin sister come too? He's like, you got a twin sister? Bring her along. And
this year's Iditarod may separate the two, at least for a while. Christy, who ran this year's Yukon Quest, finishing ninth, is running her third Iditarod.
On the first two, I kind of ran puppy teams, and this year I've got only two yearlings on my team, so it'll be fun to maybe push them a little bit harder and see what they're capable of. And I run Paul's dogs, and this year's like 5 or 6 two-year-olds and then some older dogs, so it's kind of a mixture.
That Paul she mentions is Paul Gebhardt, a 16-time Iditarod veteran and consistent top finisher. Gebhardt says he gave his Iditarod team to Christy on the quest.
Christy wanted to do it, and she wanted to, so she took my team, and I know she'd take good care of them. In fact, she won the humanitarian award over there, so that's how good she took care of them. The vets could even realize that, so we used it as a training run for the Iditarod.
Anna, who has handled dogs for her sister the past two Iditarods, is running her rookie Iditarod race.
Everything I've done up to this point, I hopefully has prepared me for this. I'm running Dean Osmar's dogs. I've worked with Dean now this is my third year working with him.
And the dogs that will get them to Nome?
Yeah, I've got a couple of really nice leaders. Two of my favorite dogs are Vinny and Vandal. And when me and Christy first went up to work for Dean, they were 4 months old. So we'd take them for free runs on the beach and harness break them and take them on their first runs. And now they're 4 years old and now they're my lead dogs. And I took them on their very first race, so to see them progress that they have is, it's really special relationship with them. I've got a dog named Nicholas, and Paul and I worked with him a whole bunch, and he turned into be a pretty good dog and ran our first Iditarod together, and then our second Iditarod together. We just finished the quest together, and now we're going to run our next Iditarod together, and he's turned into just a really great lead dog for me.
Anna and Christy will be among the 66 dog drivers in this year's race. The twins will draw for their starting positions at tonight's Iditarod banquet. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Annie Fite from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The Alaska Energy Authority announces the 2012 Commercial Energy Audit Program. Owners of eligible commercial buildings throughout Alaska, including nonprofits, may be reimbursed for qualifying energy audit. Go to akenergyauthority.org to apply online. Applications are due to AEA by Wednesday, March 28th. Energy efficiency is good for business. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.